Welcome to Mavens Talk, the podcast where we spotlight the brilliant women driving change in San Antonio's nonprofit world. I'm Carrie Dyer, co-host of the podcast. Each episode, we dive into real conversations about leadership, purpose, challenges, and triumphs, because behind every powerful mission is a woman with a story worth telling. This is Mavens Talks, where women lead and stories inspire. And now meet my co-host, the one and only Paige, an entrepreneurial Swiss Army knife with a heart for the community and a mind for strategy. Hello, Paige.
Hi, you're too kind, Carrie. Always too kind. Well, I'm excited for this podcast because Jennifer Moriarty is pretty sought out. I feel like her time is very valuable. Carrie and I actually tried to RSVP to see you talk at a nonprofit council event, I think with Laura Vaccaro. And it was like it was at capacity and we weren't able to come see
and we're members. We're members and we couldn't come. So you are a highly sought after speaker.
Yes.
Thanks for being here with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, let me do a little bio on you. Jennifer is the founder of the Moriarty Consulting Group, and I just saw that it's your 10-year anniversary recently. Congratulations. She's a powerhouse in the world of facilitation and strategy. With over 30 years of leadership experience spanning corporate and nonprofit finance, she brings a rare and valuable perspective to the table. Jennifer is known for guiding groups through intentional, inclusive processes that lead to impactful decisions and lasting outcomes. Her background includes senior roles at Wells Fargo and USAA, and she holds multiple certifications in economic development, public participation, and facilitation. She's deeply committed to her community and serves on several nonprofit boards and has been recognized with numerous awards for leadership and service. So thank you again for being here. So let's start off. What is your morning routine? What did you do this morning to get ready for your day?
Oh boy. I am always up early, but I'm a real slow start. So I have to sit around and drink my coffee for a good half hour, hour, check my emails, see what's what, maybe respond to some client things. But my morning starts off pretty slow and I'm happy to not have to be anywhere till 9 o'clock.
I love that.
That's my perfect day.
Nice. Well, let's get into a little more serious, career oriented. You've led banking initiatives, community development, and nonprofit strategy. But what's the one household chore that still brings you to your knees? That's not serious or career oriented. But what?
I love to cook, but I hate going to the grocery store.
Oh, me too.
I don't know why. I don't have a good reason for it, but my husband is more than happy to go to the grocery store. And he's a very patient man because he always comes home and, you know, I bitch about, oh, you didn't get the right waffles or something. This, you know, kind of continues on and he's tolerated me for 25 years. And
good. There's hope for me.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. If I have to go, it's like, I'll go to the smallest, like I'll go to Trader Joe's maybe, but otherwise, no, I'm not going to be.
I have no idea why. It's just a,
I'm curbside. I was living in Austin when curbside came out before 2020. So like they tested it out in Austin right after our twins were born in 2018. And I don't think I went into the grocery store for about 7 years after the twins were
born. Oh,
wow. Because, well, I mean, I went in every so often, but I didn't know where anything was because I was got so accustomed. I mean, once you have twin boys, you're not taking them anywhere in public. So the
Okay, Jennifer, you've worked at the intersection of corporate finance, community development, and nonprofit leadership for over 3 decades. How has this cross-sector experience shaped the way you guide nonprofits in strategic decision-making?
Well, I think that since I started off in finance and mortgage lending, I've always had this aptitude for wanting to be involved in community or volunteering or philanthropy in some way since I was little. I didn't set out to be a finance major. I think I kind of did that because it was an expectation my dad had of me, but it has served me really well because I was able to translate that into a, you know, pretty good little mortgage lending career when I started off. And the one thing that really lit me up about that was first-time home buyers. I loved working on first-time home buyers files because there was an excitement about seeing them do something that was, their dream and something new. I wasn't as excited about people that were on to buying their third or fourth home. And I think that just always translated through my career. And it translated in me being really effective when I was in banking and moving into community development, because I knew how to do the spreadsheets, I knew how to do the projections, I knew how to do sources and uses, and all of those things were really essential. So at that time, I was working on a lot of affordable housing and economic development activities. And so it was really helpful to have that lens. And now I think I really work hard to ground clients that I work with and understanding their financials, using data, making sure that they're always making decisions that are all about the client, but from a really data-informed perspective and from a perspective of making sure that they're moving at the speed of their own capacity, that they understand their financial structures. I don't expect a nonprofit CEO to be able to do journal entries, but I do expect that they can explain their balance sheet. And so I think I have kind of that strength and that balance. But being in the for-profit sector and being in banking, I sat at this kind of pivot point between being a corporate person, but being a corporate person in community. And I enjoyed that. And you had to flex back and forth. And I think what I always saw as the missed opportunity, and I still see it somewhat, is that we tend to keep corporate folks siloed and nonprofit folks siloed. And I would even say, we do that sometimes with funders. Funders are kind of gathering and deciding, what's important in community, and nonprofits are on the other side. And there's always this mix, because it's where they meet in the middle that change really starts to occur and good things happen. And so I think that there's still quite a bit of opportunity there. I think it's probably the pain point between nonprofit board members and CEOs, is that there's always kind of this power dynamic going on. And so I think I've always tried to work hard to bridge that piece of it, and really kind of leaning into community and lived experience and the voice of community and shaping what they need instead of what somebody else thinks that they need, whether it's a corporate person or a funder or whatever that looks like. So, it's a balancing act.
Hugely valuable. I can see how that is a huge asset to nonprofits because I think you need each other to make it work. But how do you communicate? Because sometimes it feels like it's different languages. I mean, sometimes it feels like the corporate world's talking over here about what's the need of the community, and the nonprofit world, who's working usually with the people that have the need, have a different way of talking about it and the language that they use. And it sounds like you're able to straddle those and almost be like the translator.
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, that's always my goal, is, to move towards collaboration and away from control, whether it's, a funder or a CEO, of a for-profit organization serving on a board. I think everybody intends to do well. And, I think early on in my career, when we were taught what a leader is, it always kind of felt like, at least I was raised, a leader knows the answers, knows the path that you need to go down, all of this kind of stuff. And I think in this work, you really have to show up more as a facilitative leader. You have to really show up and ask a lot of questions and be in listening mode and really have profound respect for everyone at the table. So it was pretty typical of me to show up. If you'd given me a report to review for a board conversation, I would have read the report and I would have had the answer before I got to the meeting. And unless I'm facilitated, I will trounce all over everybody with, "I've got the answer, and here we go." And so, it was really going through the facilitation certification journey that I really deeply leaned into understanding what profound respect meant for everyone around the table, and understanding that the wisdom's typically in the room and it's coming from a lot of different sources. And I needed to show up with a lot more humility and a lot more open mind to kind of listen to all of the different ideas, the lived experience that I didn't have. And it was okay not to show up with the answers, that it was okay to show up and go, I've got some learning to do. I have questions, and I can't be effective unless I understand the whole landscape. So that was a humbling experience to go through. And hopefully I show up better now, whether I'm on a board or but it's my nature to just kind of be, I'm all in, and sometimes that doesn't work so well for everybody around me.
What is your most valuable certification right now that you have?
I would say the national certification I got as a facilitator through the Institute of Cultural Affairs, and it's called Technology Participation, and it really does kind of ground you in a method for having a conversation, for leading brainstorming, for creating action plans, for doing strategic planning. And it really focuses in on profound respect for those that are in the room, and how do you get everybody's voice together in a way that everybody feels heard, but you aren't sitting there kind of hemming and hawing and analyzing for days and days and days. So it's a very structured approach to getting everybody to understand the data, to think about how it feels, and then to think about what are your options, and then to move into a decision. Me several decades ago would move right into a decision, and I wouldn't make space for people to kind of go, we tried this before, or this is where we have experience before, and here's all the options for us to think about. I'd kind of zero in on what I thought was the only option that I knew of. And so I think that was really transformative for me, whether it's with my own family or whether it's with a client. My son was in high school when I was going through my facilitation training, and I don't know what he was annoyed about, but one day he goes, "And you call yourself a facilitator?" And I thought, I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but I thought, I don't know what to tell you, bud. I'm trying my best.
Sounds like a teenager. That's what that sounds like.
Amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, your actions show that you are a lifelong learner. And when we talked the last time, you mentioned that you are starting a new program in the fall.
I am. I am. I'm a, I
Tell us about that.
applied and was accepted to a cohort program through the Lilly School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. So I am going to work on a PhD there, and I am going to focus on, I wanted to do a PhD program for a long time, but I didn't know what I would focus it on. I didn't want to do it just for the sake of doing it. I wanted it to create something of value for community. And so I'm really kind of leaning into the governance space and where the misfires happen between authority and decision making, between boards and their CEO and the community being served or represented. I think there's still work there to be done. I haven't come across anything in my 10 years as a consultant that really provides the clarity and the depth of what that looks like. And it looks different across different organizations, whether it's a chamber of commerce, another social service organization, college, university. They're all very different. And I think it gets really messy when people try to come in with one experience base and apply that to the new board that they're serving on. And so I kind of want to sort out something that I think is a tool that's useful for kind of creating the clarity around who has the authority and how are decisions being made.
What has been your most extreme board leadership experience that you've had to go in and be the facilitator or mediator, or something that one of them that sparked your interest or was memorable? And how did you navigate through making a thoughtful process for both and leadership?
The one that comes to mind is something I worked on not too long ago, but it was an exiting CEO who had been there for 10 years, very, very proud of the work that they had done, and had hired me for a couple of years to come in and do the annual board retreat, and was hiring me to come in and do the conversation about how they were going to approach replacing the CEO. And what got messy about it was this CEO really was advocating for their number two person to step into the role. and really was overstepping their role a little bit in dictating to the board what needed to happen next. And it really is the board's decision. So much so that even when I had a conversation with the board chair was, even though she'd seen me for several years at retreats, was really reluctant to talk to me because she felt like I was just going to follow what the CEO wanted done and didn't know how much she could trust me. And the CEO's message to the board chair was, Jen works for me. So it got really messy because at the end of the day, my role is to work for the organization, and to help them get to the best decision, regardless of these personalities. And so there was some very strong personalities involved, very smart people with really good intentions. But, that was just another good example of people really misunderstanding what's their decision, what's their authority, and how that should play out. And even then, helping the board chair navigate how they're translating that information. And so, making sure that board chair is showing up as a facilitative leader, not somebody that's making decisions on behalf of the entire board, because they weren't authorized to do that. And so, I mean, that's pretty typical, but it was kind of messy, and it was, and I, I just had to remind myself to stand firm and do what was best for the organization, even though I had two of the top leaders at odds with each other, and sometimes just at odds with the process. So it was a little messy, but we got through it. We got there. So.
Wow, you did your job. That's why people need people like you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, you've led community investment efforts at major institutions like Wells Fargo and USAA. What are some common missteps nonprofits make when they are engaging with corporate partners? How can they
Ooh.
build more like meaningful long-term relationships?
Yeah, that's a difficult one because there's always that power dynamic that exists, and the nonprofit always feels a little bit like, oh, I got to show up, I got to kiss up, I got to, do whatever. And to me, that's frustratingly I hate to see that because I don't like a nonprofit leader who's a subject matter expert in their space. Not feeling like they can show up and level set with a corporate partner. I think, the best thing you can do is one, recognize that there is a power dynamic and then try to move past that and try to find the space that you have shared goals. So when I was, I was with two big banks, and so most of what we wanted to fund was related to things that were aligned with the Community Reinvestment Act, that were about small business, about home ownership, about anything that had to do with lending or building investments, something like that. And so for a nonprofit to come out of the blue and not have paid attention to what our focus was, is a miss. And so I think they have to recognize, one, that not all corporate people understand community the way you wish they did. And you have a great opportunity to help educate them about it. So come with information, come with a sense of urgency, come with something that gets them fully engaged, but come asking a lot of questions of them, what's important to them. Because I think those corporate people want to talk about what's important to them. They kind of want to get to where there's this is what I want to fund, this is what you're doing. That's great. Let's figure it out in between. And I often had those kind of relationships with organizations where I'd say, we're all about financial literacy at this point. If there's a opportunity for us to fund that, to work within that, that's great. Let's talk. So I think nonprofits sometimes just have to do the relationship building part of things to kind of suss out what's this corporate person interested in. And then to recognize that they really need to, the sweet spot is when they can move that corporate relationship into something much broader. So when I was at Wells Fargo, we were much more likely to fund organizations where we We had people on the board. We had volunteer opportunities for our team to get involved in, that it was aligned with priorities that are important to us. And it was less about the money, and it was more about the full scope of how do we have a broad relationship with this organization. And over time, I mean, it's a one and done is, and some funders are like that. Some funders just like to fund things one time and move on. And it's like, well, people are still hungry next week. So are you gonna fund them over time until the problem's gone? Or are you just gonna kind of do these photo op things? And it's actually why I left the corporate space, because it was shortly after the financial meltdown in the late 2008 or so. My job really pivoted from being about community development to being about relationship management. And that's not what I signed up to do. Didn't like doing it. I didn't like, the big check presentations and acting like, oh, aren't we wonderful? And I'm like, we're a drop in the bucket against their budget. And here I am, saying I need a photo op for $5,000. It was just like, no, thank you. I don't want to do that anymore. I really want to do the on the ground work and working closely with organizations. So that's what I moved to.
That's great. That's amazing and inspiring that you were able to really like do a gut check and be like, yeah, this is not with my value set. So I love that. Well, as someone who's both served on and trained nonprofit boards, what do you believe separates a good board from a great one? And what should executive directors do to cultivate that greatness?
I would say, for the executive director, make sure that your board is well informed. Use data, help them understand the problem that you're trying to solve. So when I do planning work with groups, I always ask for 2 years' worth of board minutes, and I want to read through what the board's talking about over time. And what I most often see is a lot of conversation about the next fundraiser and who's selling tables and who's getting auction items. All of that's important, but it tends to be a lot of the conversation. And what I don't see enough conversation about is, wait, what was the problem that we were created to solve? And are we making progress in solving that for anyone? And so it gets moved at the board level along very kind of tactical activities, and it loses its grounding in whose life are we trying to improve, and how do we know that we're actually improving their life? And so I always start planning work with that. And I think if you're it's hard to keep a board member excited about something if they don't understand the problem and the dynamics and the things that they're truly impacting. I mean, I can't get excited about a fundraiser if I just think, oh, it's a fundraiser. If it's a fundraiser because I know we're trying to serve 100 more clients over the next year that need XYZ, then I'm really tying it back to the mission of the organization and why they were created at all. So I think helping the board stay in that space matters a lot, and it needs to be more than the mission moment activities. It needs to be really, how do we survey people? What are they saying? And you need to track that over time, whether it's your financials, whether it's your outcomes, whatever that looks like, because most board members tend to remember what was in the last board package, what was the last conversation. And it's hard to make sense of something that's evolved over 2 years if you're not looking at your own data over 2 years to kind of go, yeah, things are getting better, or are they staying flat, or what does this actually look like? So I think, getting the board involved in that work, I think probably one of the more challenging things that CEOs can do with or to their board is to have that hammer about you must fundraise, you must fundraise, you must fundraise, because that's the thing that most board members are like, I hate to fundraise, I don't want to fundraise, I don't like doing this. And they don't really understand that, fundraising is sometimes just going, I'll call the five donors and thank them. I mean, I can do that as a board member. And there's really nothing that says that a board's responsibility is to fundraise. A board's responsibility is oversight and governance. Fundraising is a necessary thing to ensure resources, but some organizations don't need to fundraise. And so, bravo if you've got earned income or you've got other things going on. But when all it feels like is you're being asked to ask for money, it can be really off-putting, and it's hard to do that. It's easier to ask for money if you're like, let me tell you why. Because we're serving 300 kids a year, and here's the issue that they're constantly facing, and here's how we're making a difference. Boards need to get really, really clear about that, and I think that's kind of a lot of the opportunity that's yet to be completely elevated.
What do you find is an like do you have like a recommendation like that you're willing to share as like a best practice for making sure the board is like kind of on the same page like about like before they ever walk into the boardroom they know like what their expectations are. Do you think it's good for them to go to a board webinar or to have a board packet that they have to sign or contract or whatever? Do you have kind of as in your role, do you kind of recommend that boards do certain things to make sure that no one's like, wait, I was supposed to buy a table?
Well, I mean, I've been recruited for these boards that go something like, oh, we only meet 4 times a year. We don't take much of your time at all. It's really no big deal. And I've gone, okay, I'll do that. And when I was in the corporate world, I had to be interested in a lot of things and show up for a lot of different roles. And so I got smarter towards the end of my corporate career in saying, let me find somebody that would be a good fit for you as a board. But I think, I mean, I do a lot of board governance training, and I always ask for the raised hands about who had a good board orientation when you were recruited to the board. And that's kind of the thing that we never make enough time for. And
Totally.
so, one, doing it up front, kind of setting those expectations up front and being really clear about if your board always meets the first Wednesday of the month at noon, tell somebody that, because if their schedule doesn't allow that, then it's a no. Tell them what giving expectations are. Tell them that they have to, they're expected to serve on a committee. Tell them that they're expected to buy a table for the fundraiser, whatever that looks like. And I think, it's really smart to have an interview process where a couple of board members are interviewing this board candidate, because the board candidate should feel like they're trying to figure out if this is a good fit for them. And the board needs to be listening for, wait, you serve on 7 other boards and you're really kind of pounding your chest about that. I don't think you're going to have time for us. And so they need to be kind of sorting that out and seeing, are they a good fit? And then once they bring them on, really do a solid orientation and do it over time. I did a board orientation for a board that I was on, and I swear they gave me like a 3-inch thick book, which is like, great, you're giving me all kinds of stuff. And I sat through maybe a 2-hour orientation, and then at one of my first board meetings, I raised my hand and said, I need to understand XYZ. And somebody kind of raised their eyebrow at me and said, it was in your notebook, Jen. And it was kind of, I was a little bit shamed, and it's like, I'm still drinking out of a fire hose over here. And that was a huge notebook. And so, create space for people to ask questions and get them involved right away, because I think the boards that I've served on that I did not miss a meeting. I didn't miss a meeting because, one, I felt very strongly about that organization's mission. But two, I really like the other people on the board, and I really like the CEO, and I really like the staff. And I didn't want to let anybody down that I personally liked and respected. So you also have to create that space so that people can feel like, I can say, I don't get what we're trying to do here, and not have somebody shame them or silence them. That, it goes back to that profound respect for everybody in the room and making space for that. So yeah, I would say, remember to orient people, have them attend activities, have them meet with the staff, have them see the program while it's operating, whatever that needs to look like. Invest time in doing that. And the best way to do that is to make sure that you have a governance committee, not just a nominating committee for your organization. And that governance committee sees that as, our work is year round. We're planning the next retreat. We're recruiting 2 board members. We're onboarding 3 new board members month after next. Whatever that looks like, it's a lot of work when it's done well. but it's also has the biggest payoff because organizations that don't have good alignment between what the board understands their role to be and the CEO are disasters. And it just consumes so much time with negative energy that can come out of that kind of scenario.
Oh, that's so true. I mean, it all makes so much sense. And being able to put that time in at the beginning seems a little stressful and strenuous and takes up too much time. But once you can get that foundation, things settle and it's much more worth it in the long run.
And, quite honestly, there are so many resources out there now. I mean, when I first joined a board in the 90s, the only book that I was aware of was called Am I Liable? And it was like, well, that's an interesting premise to start everybody off with. What problem am I going to get on for serving on this board? Let me check this out.
Get
And now
your own
there's so much
Elantra
else
and
out there.
everybody. Did they give you that book?
I don't remember
Oh,
who
okay.
gave me the book, but I mean, I have it. I have it on,
Okay.
on my bookshelf. But it was,
Amazing.
BoardSource didn't have all the resources. There's Joan Gary's out there. I mean, there's so many ways that you can, lean into a board. But I will also say that, our community is full of a lot of really smart, well-intentioned people that have served on boards for 30 years and they've never picked up any of those resources. So they kind of continue with the old practices, and then there's a lot of younger people that are just hungry for the information and want to do their work right, and there's a ton of resources to support them. I do think, I'm certified by BoardSource. That was another training that I went through because I found out pretty early on that it doesn't matter what I facilitate if nobody understands their roles and what good governance looks like. So I went through that process, and they have really good resources that are full books as PDFs to handouts that are 1 or 2 pages. And I always tell my clients, it seems like you got a sticking point around this. Why don't you bring this 2-page handout to the next board meeting and just make space for everybody on the board to have read that and then talk about what it means to your organization? So it kind of neutralizes the issue that might be existing and kind of says, here's the tool that we should be looking at now. Now let's see what's relatable to us. I also think surveying the board is a good idea. Sometimes when you survey a board and you get a sense of how they feel like they're doing together, people will say things in a survey that they may not say in an open meeting. But if you can do a survey and then you can say, look at this, half of you all have an issue with XYZ, or two-thirds of you think what we're doing this really well, then it gives people permission to go, oh, I'm not the only one. Great. And then they'll finally speak up. So I think there's a lot of, really easy tools and practices that people can adopt that helps improve whatever they want to focus on.
And you started to bring up, the next generation. To those next generations of change makers, if you had like a megaphone to inspire them, like what would you say?
I would say, there's a saying, don't plan with me, not for me. And so really get grounded in understanding the community and the community dynamics and what the issues are in community. Lean into building those relationships as well. I think over my career, I've work closely with COPS Metro. I've worked with deeply in community with folks that you probably wouldn't think a corporate person would get highly aligned with, but they teach me so much and really help me understand things that weren't part of my experience growing up. I mean, I grew up with working class parents and education was incredibly important, and we didn't always have a lot, but I think if you look at me, you might have a different perspective. Oh, here's this blonde woman. What could she possibly know about the dynamics in our community? But I hopefully have spent a lot of time trying to understand those dynamics or asking questions when I don't. When I was hired at Wells Fargo, there was a real concern about hiring this white woman to be the face of the bank and community. And I was told later, they made a lot of phone calls around community to ask about me, to say, does she understand this community? How will she be received in this part of the community, et cetera, et cetera. And so they really did their homework about me to see if I could be somebody that could be trusted and be authentic and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's incredibly important. So I would say, coming up in this space, no matter what you are and what your background is, you really have to listen before you lead. And you have to constantly be listening and constantly asking questions and really show up with a lot of humility and lose your judgment. I mean, it was I think Carrie, I think of you, I think of Broadway Bank, right? I think of your family and stuff. And I worked closely with Jeanette Westbrook back in the 90s. And we were both on working with neighborhood housing services. And one of the things that the banks at that time did was we would adopt a bunch of houses that were identified by homeowners that needed repairs, needed to be painted, all of that kind of stuff. And we would send out contractors to shore up broken windows or rotted wood or whatever that looked like. And then the bankers would all come in with our volunteer team and we would paint the houses for the day.
Oh, I did that with my dad.
Did
Yeah,
you? Yeah.
a lot. Yeah.
It was fun. But it was also interesting that, every once in a while I'd have a group of our volunteers show up and they would kind of go, oh, so we're painting their house. Did you notice they have a new big screen TV inside? And it would be like, and your point is, I mean, very judgy about, well, do you think that maybe that's this family's primary source of entertainment? And so you have an opinion about that? Do you think, where are you going for vacation? Oh, you just got back from Europe. Wow. Do you think, I mean, lose the judgment. Lose the judgment and lean into the humanity of what you're doing. That was a pretty clear lesson and something I had to think about when I was bringing volunteers out in community. Would they show up respectfully? In neighborhoods and be able to engage with the homeowner who's this could feel overwhelming to them. They don't know who these people are. They don't know if we're scamming them. They don't know, really what's going on. So yeah.
That's a great perspective to have. I love that. And I love the, seeing someone with your success and your track record and feeling that intimidation about, working with people like you and learning the community. But when you focus on just showing up and listening and asking good questions and not having to know the answer to everything, I think that's important and kind of welcomes that new generation in. And it's very helpful. And I think you're a very generous person with all that you share and just, reaching out. And when I reached out, like just meeting with me. So thank you. Thank you for doing
You.
that in our community.
It's a long game. If you're going to be involved in community, it's a long game. And one of the things that I would have to tell our bankers sometimes, if I needed bankers to show up at some community event, a lot of times they were motivated by, oh, I'm going to open new accounts. And I'm like, you're not. If you do, bravo. But first, people have to know how much you care. Before they're going to engage with you. And that can be multiple months, years worth of work before somebody goes, ah, I can trust these people. These are good people. Whatever that needs to look like. So, get ready to play the long game because these relationships will be with you for years if you're part of this community for years. And this is a very small community. Very small. Yeah.
Great advice.
I have one question for you before we get into the rapid fire questions, but what would you tell, and this is kind of a cheesy question, but you have such an illustrious career and you have all these different paths. What would you tell your 21-year-old self that started in finance doing mortgage lending?
Oh boy. Wow. I would tell myself to put myself out there more, and that there is space for everyone to be at the table. And when I was very young in my career, in the mortgage career, there was a, I don't even know if it exists anymore, but there was a newspaper called the Real Estate Newsline. And it was kind of like all of the stuff that was going on in the real estate business and pictures at this event, and pictures at that event, and all this kind of stuff. It was like the rag sheet, right, for that part of the industry. And the man that published that paper, and I was early 20s, he took me out to lunch once and he said, "I got to give you some feedback." And I said, "Oh, okay." And he said, "When you walk into a room, you have a presence about you." And he said, "People notice you." And I was like, "Okay." And he said, "You're never smiling. Do you realize that?" And it was kind of a bit of a wake-up call to me because I grew up with parents that were politically active, that were very social, but it was really common for me to be taken to whatever event and be parked in the adjacent room with the TV or something like that. So I never thought I was visible. I thought my role was to kind of walk in, go over there, sit quietly, whatever. And so then in my own career, I didn't realize how I was showing up. And I think I would have told myself to push harder on being comfortable in those spaces. Because it really is, if you're an introvert like I am, I really am an introvert, I have to push myself to show up. But unless I show up with a smile and with a generous spirit, nobody wants to work with you. Nobody wants to work with crappy pants and, when they walk in the room. So I think I would have kind of push myself to kind of have a little bit more confidence in how I was coming into a room.
Well, that's good for Carrie and I as both introverts as well.
Oh, you're
That's
on
very
stage.
relatable. Actors can be introverts,
Yeah,
I tell you.
it's surprising. It takes a lot of energy too,
Yeah, oh
but
my, so much
it's very
energy.
much a, you have to practice it for sure.
Yes.
At least I have. Yeah.
Oh,
For
it's
sure.
true. Okay, we're going to wrap this up with some fun questions.
Okay.
So, tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Ooh, sneakers or heels?
Sneakers.
Your favorite meeting spot out of your home office or your office?
Oh. Like meeting with the client? Meeting with
Meeting with a prospective client or
probably a coffee shop, something like that, someplace quiet, because I wear hearing aids and I mess up words sometimes. So I'm always nervous about, am I catching what everybody's saying?
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay. Zoom, Google Meets, or WebEx?
Zoom.
Agreed.
Favorite nonprofit event of the year?
Nonprofit event of the year? Is that what you said?
Yes.
I hate to say, but it's coordination.
Great answer. That's so fun. Okay.
It's fun.
Did you go the year that my husband was Dorothy? Oh my gosh, that was a few
I
years.
don't know. I've had a table at coordination for probably at least 15 years, so
How fun. I love that.
maybe, yeah, maybe.
Probably then.
Yeah, now I get my son to go with me with his girlfriend. His girlfriend loves it, and he just, I mean, one of the best parts of the evening is just watching his face as he has to watch the show.
It's something. It's always interesting. Love it. So much fun. Okay, last one. Reading or watching? And what is it that you are reading or watching lately?
Right now, I just started a book about the Great Migration from the South to the North. So that's got me a little bit fascinating because it doesn't really have a set start. It just started happening where Black families started moving towards the North, and what that looked like and the impact it had on the United States. So I'm a little interested in that. Yeah.
That's very fascinating.
And then I'm also reading, I really like this book, From Generosity to Justice.
Oh, cool.
Darren Walker. He's the president of the Ford Foundation.
Yeah,
And
that's great.
I've enjoyed that. Yeah. So, and then I do get sucked into mindless TV quite a bit.
Good,
We have
good.
to have something to
Yeah,
let our
we want
minds
some
wander.
entertainment.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. We know you are busy, you have a lot going on, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today and be one of our first podcast guests. It's so awesome. And for everybody else listening, we will chat next week.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me, and good luck to both of you as you go down your own consulting paths.
Thank you.
Thank you.